The Lisa Wexler Show podcast is brought to you by Winston Prep School for Kids with Learning Disabilities. Visit winstonprep.edu. Also brought to you by Onboard Services. For your staffing and engineering needs, go to onboardusa.com.
Attorney, advocate, author, public speaker, The Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600. Flip that switch and turn on your brain. Here is Lisa Wexler.
So it's Wednesday, and I think we'll do a You Be the Judge at 11:30, and I encourage you to play. 203-333-9422. A story coming out of Greenwich caught my eye. I wanted to discuss it with you. So it seems that, I actually spoke about this yesterday, that there were these signs that went up all over Greenwich. And there was a whole hullabaloo about them because they're political signs. They're going up in the context of a very heated campaign between Jill Oberlander and Fred. I'm losing my Fred C. Fred. Oh, Lisa, I can see his face. Fred Camillo. Fred Camillo and Jill Oberlander are running a very heated campaign for the direction of Greenwich. And Peter Tesi, who is leaving, I think he served 5 terms of 2 years each. He's going on to other things in his life. He's still a young man, but he doesn't want to do it anymore. And there has been a trend in Greenwich throughout the last few years of skewing much more Democratic than it ever did in the past. And in fact, Jill Oberlander won along with a majority on the BET, which is the large board of finance that governs Greenwich. Greenwich is, it calls itself a town, but it really is a small city. And it's got, I think, at least 60,000 people in it, somewhere in that neighborhood. It's about 25 square miles. It's very large. It has large acreage. It has a large population of people that qualify for free school lunches. It is by no means all rich, but it has some very, very wealthy people in it, some very, very poor people in it, and like a lot of other communities, a lot of people in between. And it has a very active and commercially vital downtown. And so, and in Greenwich, we know that many of our public servants come from Greenwich. Governor Lamont lives in Greenwich. Senator Blumenthal lives in Greenwich. Congressman Himes lives in Greenwich. So of the top four that matter to us, only Christopher Murphy doesn't. 3 out of 4 are in Greenwich. So this campaign for the direction of Greenwich, the local first selectman campaign, it matters, not just to the people in Greenwich, but to a lot of us along the Gold Coast as we watch, because Greenwich has, in some cases, occupied a position of political leadership from time to time. So the contest is a very interesting one, and it's a bellwether to some extent of a lot of Fairfield County communities in terms of a waning Republican majority giving rise to more Democrats serving local office. So these signs really garnered a lot of controversy because they placed the name of Camillo next to Trump. The signs themselves associated Camillo with Trump. They were Camillo / Trump. And they did not tell you who they were paid by. They did not tell you what political party they came from. But Mr. Camillo was very offended because he's running for local office and he doesn't want to be formally associated with Donald Trump. He wants people to vote for him based on his merit as a state rep and based on what he has done lifelong for the community of Greenwich. He was born and raised there, never lived anywhere else, as far as I know. And he wants to be elected on a Greenwich platform. So he didn't like the association with Trump. And so the Republicans initially, they sought to blame the Democrats because they thought, oh, this is a Democratic tactic, associating a Republican's name with Donald Trump in order to win, because there are a lot of people in the community who don't like Trump. And Trump is such a polarizing name right now. He's such a polarizing figure in our White House that it's like a pool cue sometimes. People are pushing him to the other end of the pool table. So this has been a matter of tremendous consternation and controversy. And in the midst of this, in the midst of this query, and by the way, and everybody in office was denying having put the signs, the police administration learned on Monday that police captain of Greenwich, Mark Kordick, in fact, was involved in the placement of fake signs. Now, this story was breaking over a day or two. And Kordick admitted that, yes, he had paid for the signs. And he told why. He spoke to the Greenwich Free Press. He also bought the domain fredcamillo.com, which he put on the signs to identify that fredcamillo.com was associated with the signs. And when you go on fredcamillo.com, you're directed to citizensfortrump.com. He says that he has a right in an expression of the First Amendment, and he lives in Greenwich, to put those signs out. But the police put him on paid administrative leave Monday afternoon. They are not letting him do his job as a Greenwich police officer. And they are reviewing the incident to determine if any of the Greenwich Police Department's rules, regulations, or policies were violated. Greenwich Police Chief Heavey, in a press release on Monday, said that Mark Kordick was placed on paid administrative leave because Kordick may have been involved in some way in the placement of, quote, alleged fake political signs that have caused much controversy throughout town this past week. And that Kordick confirmed a level of personal involvement. The release said the police administration will reserve passing judgment until all the facts are reviewed, and Captain Kordick will be afforded all the due process rights in which he is entitled. 203-333-9422. Should Captain Kordick be punished for putting out a political sign in the middle of a campaign season? What do you think? 203-333-9422. Call me at 203-333-9422. Peter Tesi, who was still the first selectman, said it is questionable actions such as this that besmirch the otherwise outstanding reputation of the Greenwich Police Department. One would expect better. But Captain Kordick explained that though he did not put the signs in the ground himself, he first did consult the State Elections Enforcement Committee, SEEC, regarding the legality of his plan. He said he acted alone. And he said the signs point out his hypocrisy, referring to Camillo. That's the leader of the Republican Party. In other words, he's saying, as far as he's concerned, in his opinion, in his political free speech opinion, Fred Camillo can't run away from Donald Trump as the leader of the Republican Party. And he's done nothing wrong to associate the name of Trump with Camillo because Camillo is an endorsed Republican. And he said each of the signs was legally placed on town property right alongside other public political signs. I'm a Greenwich resident. I'm a taxpayer. I'm a voter. My free speech has been breached by their removal. I've never denied I did it. I have not been untruthful. I participated in it. The RTC chair, Rich DiPretta, issued a statement saying it is deeply troubling that Mark Kordick, a registered Democrat and captain of the Greenwich Police Department, has been identified as the individual behind the fraudulent Camillo campaign signs. I am confident that the police will conduct an exhaustive investigation to determine which laws Mr. Kordick broke, if any, regarding this incident. And he said that DiPretta said that the signs were not an exercise of free speech, but they were a form of impersonation because they were designed to appear as if they were from the Camillo campaign to undermine his campaign's message. And he says that because of the underneath it where it has a website. He said if Mr. Kordick was so proud of his involvement and his right to free speech, why did he do it anonymously? Indivisible Greenwich, which is a very proactive pro-Democrat party, they said in a statement on Tuesday that first selectman candidate Fred Camillo belies his own campaign slogan, Uniting Greenwich, and shows again why he shouldn't lead this town. Because he accused Indivisible Greenwich of having planted them, and now somebody else has taken responsibility for doing it, and we had nothing to do with it. And then they go on to other things. So, in an email on Tuesday, the chair of the DTC said neither Captain Kordick nor his wife is a member of the DTC. And the DTC says, we recognize that Captain Kordick has the right to express his political views, But we believe he should have been transparent in doing so. If the signs had said vote Democrat because Camillo had failed to denounce President Trump, that would have been fair. And then they go into the specifics of the campaign. Greenwich Police Captain Mark Kordick said he did buy the signs, but he didn't actually put them in the ground. That's what he told the Greenwich Free Press. And he said at the end of the day on Monday, Deputy Police Chief Mark Marino placed him on paid administrative leave from his job, effective immediately. He said it was about the signs and asked if I was responsible for the purchase of the signs, and I answered truthfully that I was. And Kordick says he doesn't even understand why he was put on leave. He says the signs are like other campaign election signs. They represent his right as a citizen taxpayer and resident of Greenwich to express his free speech. And he showed a copy of an invoice from a sign company. And he said he immediately admitted it. And he did his homework first. And he spoke to the SEEC. And he said, it is okay for a regular citizen to put up political signs. I was not acting in concert with or with the consent, knowledge, or permission of any other person. And he also confirmed with the SEC that an attribution at the bottom of a sign, or unlike the paid ads on this website, is not required. As far as zoning is concerned, they say absolutely it's free speech. So what do you think? 203-333-9422. What do you think about this? A police captain in Greenwich doesn't like Donald Trump. He buys some signs, and he associates Trump with the person who is running as the Republican in town. And underneath it, he puts a website that directs you to Citizens for Trump. But the website is a website that he bought that uses the campaign candidate's name. Let's assume that's misleading. Let's assume that it is. Let's assume that there's a sign out there in politics that's misleading. Does anybody know what the First Amendment to the Constitution is? The First Amendment to the Constitution doesn't say all speech needs to be truthful to be protected. That's not what it says. It says all speech needs to be protected, truthful or not. Political speech, I'll just put my lawyer Lisa hat on for a minute. Political speech always receives the highest level of protection when analyzing whether or not something is constitutional. It's distinct from commercial speech like advertising, which has sometimes a lower level of protection. Political speech is numero uno. First Amendment, right to speak. Now, this person is a police officer, but he didn't say on the sign that he was acting as an agent of the police department. Do you think it's fair that he should be placed on leave? Yes, he's getting paid, but he's been punished. He's not able to do his job. What do you think? 203-333-9422 on the Lisa Wexler Show. You're the police captain. You find out your officer has been doing this around town. What would you do? What should you do? And is it constitutional to do so? Let's talk about it. Call me at 203-333-9422. Tomorrow's Halloween. So we've been talking about Captain Mark Kordick of the Greenwich Police Department, who was placed on paid administrative leave as a result of admitting to putting some signs around town that caused some controversy that Fred Camillo believed were misleading insofar as they put Trump next to his name, and underneath that had a website that was fredcamillo.com that is not a website that he owned and in fact directed you to Citizens for Trump. The police officer who bought these signs admits that he's angry at Donald Trump, and he says, quote, everyone in Greenwich is negatively affected by national Republican politics concerning our environment. Everyone in Greenwich is affected by national Republican politics on the federal budget and deficit. And he writes about women's rights and different rights of ethnics. And he says, I'm a Greenwich resident, taxpayer, and registered voter. My free speech has been breached by their removal. I've never denied I did it. I have not been untruthful. I participated in it. So the police department didn't see it quite his way, and they placed him on paid administrative leave. And I want to know what you think about it. I've been getting emails about it. I'm getting some feedback from you, but nobody wants to get on the air. Here's one. Liar, liar, pants on fire. Dirty tricks, very Nixonian. He should be fired. What a liar. Boo on him. So that's just a little bit of your responses out there, but you don't want to call and talk about it. Well, let's see what the ACLU has to say about it. I have a feeling they're involved. But I would say, just in general, we've got this overlying principle called the First Amendment. And really the question, you know, is going to be, when you work for the police department, you work for a government agency. And therefore, government agency, cannot punish you for exercising your right of free speech. In other words, if Mr. Kordick had worked for a private enterprise, a local store on the corner, and the owner of the store had said, hey, I don't like what you did. I think you misled the people in Greenwich. I know you've got your political beliefs, but I don't like the way you exercise them. I'm letting you go. That is a much stronger case for being able to be fired. I'm not even sure under the state laws of whatever kind of laws we have that you could be. But it's not the same as being literally working for the state, which Captain Kordick does. So he works for the state in the agency of the police department. The police department fires him for essentially exercising his free speech. And the question is going to be, you know, to what extent, if it's misleading, does it matter? So what? Does it matter whether it's misleading? Fraudulent is a very strong word. Nobody was induced with money here. Fraud implies money. Well, let's say it was a misrepresentation and it was misleading. Is that the first time there's been political speech that's been misleading by a citizen? And is that something that the state can punish someone for? Otherwise, why do we have a First Amendment? 203-333-9422. Anyway, I want to follow that story. We'll see where it goes. But that's what's happening in Greenwich. And really underneath it all, the big idea is that local Republicans, some of them, not all, don't want to be associated with Donald Trump. Don't you see? That's the real idea here. That local Republicans feel it is to their detriment to be associated with this president at this time in their community. That is not the case throughout Connecticut by any means. There are plenty of pockets of Connecticut where Republicans proudly associate themselves with President Trump, but not in today's Greenwich. In today's Greenwich, it's perceived to be a bad thing. And so Fred Camillo didn't like it. He didn't like that his name was associated with the president. And he didn't want it. And so a police officer now has been placed on paid admin leave. 26 minutes after 11, 203-333-9422. We're going to do a You Be the Judge coming up, but I did want to talk about a case, a couple of things. Oh, this one. Maybe you're interested in talking about this today. In Quinnipiac University, a professor is saying that there shouldn't be a Chick-fil-A. And the reason that there shouldn't be a Chick-fil-A is because this professor believes that Chick-fil-A is an organization that does not properly respect gay rights. And that the people that own Chick-fil-A are committed to their own biblical view of what constitutes a family. And this professor finds it offensive. And this professor, who's a woman, says, I think that our university should not allow Chick-fil-A to make money from our student body, should not be, quote, welcome on campus, because their politics are politics that I don't agree with. Journalist and professor Margarita Diaz said on Twitter, why does Quinnipiac U continue to welcome Chick-fil-A to campus? This company's ownership has zealously embraced a homophobic stance. We can do better. So the university quickly responded to say there will be scheduled conversations about their concerns. They want to understand the concerns related to using Chick-fil-A as a vendor. CEO Dan Cathy, who is the head of Chick-fil-A, has told the Baptist Press that he defines the construction of a family based on the Bible. We are a family-owned business, a family-led business, and we are married to our first wives. We give God thanks for that. And the LGBTQ advocacy organization Equality Matters has said that Chick-fil-A's charitable organization has given almost $2 million, this is back in 2010, to, quote, anti-LGBTQ organizations. But they believe that all of these allegations against them are misleading and inaccurate. And they say that they are basically a family restaurant. And, you know, obviously they're not telling people, they're not saying to people, what is your sexual status before you can come and eat our Chick-fil-A's? And they feel that they should have the right to do business. But this professor says no. This professor says that based on the political beliefs of Chick-fil-A, based on their religious beliefs as well as political beliefs, that they should not be welcome on the Quinnipiac campus. What do you think about that? 203-333-9422. Everybody getting very bent out of shape trying to punish people for what they think and how they express themselves, right? Sort of the same. People trying to punish people for having thoughts, ideas with which they disagree. It's still America. You can disagree with me anytime. I like it. 203-333-9422. Stay tuned to the Lisa Wexler Show. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the show today. You know what? Let's do You Be the Judge. Can we have a little Law and Order? That's just to get me in the mood. All right. Welcome back to the show. 203-333-9422. So today's You Be the Judge case is a little bit different. It's not a criminal matter. It has to do with something I think that many of us can relate to, and that is mortgages in our homes. And this is a case, again, making its way up to the Supreme Court in the state of Connecticut, in which a family in Monroe owned a house that was worth about $500,000. And Fleet Bank got a judgment against them for $100,000. And they couldn't pay. They couldn't pay. So they said to Fleet Bank, okay, well, we can't pay our judgment. But what we can do, Fleet Bank said, is you can't pay our judgment, so we're going to convert this judgment lien into a mortgage on your house. We've gotten a judgment against you for $100,000. And so if you sign a mortgage and you agree that you will faithfully pay us every month on this debt that you owed us, this $100,000 debt that the court said you owed us, if you agree to pay us every month on this, we'll secure that by a mortgage on your house. And we will, and they signed this fancy big word, forbear, we will sign a forbearance agreement with you, we'll sign an agreement with you, in which we agree that for as long as you are paying the mortgage on the house, we will not foreclose on your house. As long as you're paying on it, and in addition, we're going to put a clause in the mortgage that says that you waive your right to assert your homestead exemption. Now, what is a homestead exemption? We're playing You Be the Judge at 203-333-9422. And it's sort of a fun thing where I explain a fact pattern, and then you call and tell me, if you were the judge, how would you decide the case? So this is a case, so stick with me here. It's a couple of different moving parts, some complicated words, but not too complicated. The idea is that in Connecticut, like in most states, we have this thing called a Homestead Act. And in the Homestead Act, we have a homestead exemption. I think in Connecticut, it's about $75,000. And it essentially says that the first $75,000 in your home, if you were to sell it, if it were to be, if you were to have a judgment against you of bankruptcy, that you could keep that $75,000. And the interest of the state was to allow people to have some semblance of something left in their home to begin a new life. The homestead exemption in Florida is unlimited to the gross value of your house. In other words, you could spend $10 million on a house. That's your homestead exemption. Good luck to you. That means a judgment creditor cannot go after your home to the extent of $10 million. But in Connecticut, you know, we're the land of thrift and steady habits. It's a lot less. So we're not, because of that, we're not a bankruptcy haven for people who are running away from their debts. But we do have this homestead exemption. think it's at 75,000. It might be up to 125. It's not that much, but it's something. And this couple, the Sanzos, they stopped paying. So they had this $100,000 judgment against them. Fleet Bank, which later became something called Rockstone Capital, assigned it to a company called Rockstone Capital. The lender, we'll just call them the lender. The lender says, okay, instead of a judgment, we're not going to call it a judgment against us. We're going to call it a mortgage instead. You're going to pay it every month, and we're not going to go after you. And if you pay us, everything is good and wonderful. And they stopped paying, the couple. They stopped again. Again, they were in arrears. So the lender said, all right, well, we're going to foreclose on the mortgage this time. And you know what? We may have to throw you out of your house because you can't pay. And we're going to foreclose. And they said, well, wait a minute. Even if you foreclose on us, we're still entitled at the end of the day to our homestead. And the lender said, no, you're not. Now, what happened is the trial court said, yes, you are. You're entitled to your homestead. Because as a matter of public policy, we think the homestead is very important. And as a matter of public policy, Homestead Act says is that, basically it says that if you have a consensual lien, if you agree to give somebody a consensual lien, then you then can't claim the homestead against that. But the trial court said this really wasn't a consensual lien, this mortgage. This was an effort by the lender to take a judgment against you, convert it into something else, this instrument of a mortgage, which is typically a consensual lien, in order to have you not be able to protect your Homestead Act. And that's against public policy. And we're not going to enforce it, and you're going to keep your homestead exemption. That was appealed to the appellate court and then to the Supreme Court in the state of Connecticut. And the issue, and the reason I'm bringing this up, the reason it's an important issue is, because here's what happened here. See, we have these laws. We have this homestead that is designed to protect the average homeowner against losing everything in their house if something happens to them in life and somebody forecloses on them in the sense of getting a judgment against them and wants to get paid. So let's say they have a credit card company and they couldn't pay their credit card debts, and the credit card company sues, and they get a big judgment lien against you. The state of Connecticut says, yeah, they can collect everything except for the homestead part at the bottom. We have to let people have a little bit of a nest egg to move on with their life. We're not going to allow them to be completely wiped out. But the exception to that is when you consent to the lien. When you say, I'm going to waive it myself. I'm going to knowingly and voluntarily waive it. And that's typically when you give somebody a mortgage on your home. You sign a promissory note, you give them a mortgage, the bank says, I have a secured interest, I'm not interested in your homestead, who cares about your homestead? If I have to foreclose on this homestead, on this mortgage, I'm getting the whole thing if I have to. You've heard of short sales, you know what all that's about. So, in general, as a general rule, mortgages have nothing to do with homestead. They can foreclose on the whole thing. You've never heard of somebody walking away from a short sale with their homestead exemption of money, right? You've never heard of that before. That's because they don't. Because a mortgage is deemed a consensual lien. You're agreeing to it. And so what the trial court said in this case is, you know what? They signed the mortgage. But really, did they? This was Fleet Bank. Pretty sophisticated lender. They didn't originally have a mortgage on the house. They sued on some kind of a note. I don't know if it was a credit card or something else. The case didn't say. But they got a judgment, the kind of judgment that the homestead exemption was designed to protect. And the fact that they then converted it to a mortgage, we don't think that they should have been able to do that. We don't like the way the facts of this case developed. We think the homeowner was taken advantage of. And so we are avoiding this transaction as a matter of public policy. But the lender said, hold on a second. Wait a minute. What are you talking about? They had counsel. They were represented by an attorney. They agreed that they were going to pay us off month by month, and then they stopped paying again. Here are some deadbeats. Here are some people that didn't pay us the original $100,000. And then when we went back to them to try and renegotiate and restructure and figure this out, they still didn't pay us. What are you talking about a homestead here? There's no public policy being violated. They knowingly, consensually gave us a lien on their house. Your Honor, we have to collect. What kind of homestead? This is what made its way up to the Supreme Court. July of 2019. Big case. What do you think? You'd be the judge. Should the homeowner in this case have the protections of the homestead? Be able to take out their core amount of equity, whatever number that is in Connecticut law? Or not? They signed the mortgage. They signed the forbearance. They were represented by counsel. But it was originally a judgment. The lender converted it. 203-333-9422. I know it's a little bit, you know, it's not a common kind of a criminal case. It's not a good sexy case. Literally, we've done some good sexy cases. But I thought it was a good case. Go ahead, Christian. What do you think?
No, you just said no sexy case, so I went, aw.
I know. You like sexy cases. I know. Next week, I'll come back with a sexy case. But the reason this case caught my attention is whenever a judge voids a commercial transaction on the ground that it's against public policy, that makes me raise my eyebrows. Because that's rare. That's rare. That a judge says, hold on a second, bank. I don't like what you did here to these people. It's a couple in Monroe. People. Average people. I don't like what you did. I'm voiding it. I'm taking your instrument and I'm saying, no, you can't do this to people. And then it was appealed. So what do you think? 203-333-9422. Call me at 203-333-9422. Who wins, the bank or the borrower? Very simple. The bank or the borrower? Who should win? Call me at 203-333-9422. All right, we'll be right back. Tomorrow, Governor Ned Lamont joins us as well as Scott Pelley. We'll have some fun with that as well. 203-333-9422. So in today's law and order, you be the judge. Just very, very quickly, the question is the bank or the borrower who should win here in a case in which the borrower signed a mortgage after losing a judgment to that same lender, which was then converted into a mortgage, converted into a secured debt. And then the borrower didn't pay again. And the borrower said, but wait a minute, we don't think you should be able to foreclose on our house the extent of our entire equity. We want to have our homestead money at the bottom to be able to go out and have a fresh start. And the trial court said, you should, that the notion of a lender signing up a mortgage in this case was really not consensual in the sense that the statute was intended and was against public policy. But the case was appealed by the lender, and it made its way up and up and up. And the appellate court reversed the trial court and said, no, you misunderstand the statute. The lender can absolutely foreclose. There's no homestead exemption in the case where somebody signs a mortgage. And then it went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agreed with the appellate court. And it said that this was not a violation of public policy. We side with the lender, that grown-ups voluntarily can waive their rights when they sign these kinds of documents, waiving a right to exercise their right under the Homestead Act. They do so, and the mortgage was enforceable, and it was not against public policy to waive their homestead exemption. And so in Connecticut, in this kind of a situation, there is no waiver of the there is, in fact, a waiver of the homestead exemption. And in this case, the borrower lost and the lender won. So overturning the trial court. 203-333-9422 and other news stories today. And there are so many. Just a little bit of a recap. We've talked a little bit about what happened in Greenwich with the police captain who's underpaid administrative leave for putting out political signs that associate Trump with Fred Camillo. And those were not put out by Fred Camillo's campaign, nor were they put out by the Democratic campaign. So he's in hot water for that. We've also discussed what happened in Stamford, but we're going to keep a continuing eye on the case of Mr. Barrier, 23 years old, who died in police custody. He was brought to the hospital. The initial evidence does not show any kind of taser or any kind of infliction by the police, but we don't know why he died, and I'm sure that the family is anxious to get to the bottom of that. The medical examiner has not released any toxicology reports yet or anything like that, but we will keep abreast of that. Jim Himes, our own congressman, getting a lot of ink for being right in the thicket of all of these impeachment hearings because he is on the House Intelligence Committee and he is right there. And they are going to be apparently today bringing forth their report, which will go to Judiciary, which if it again comes out for a vote, will then get sent to the House for formal hearings on the impeachment of President Donald Trump, which will then go to the Senate. And right now the Senate is run by Mitch McConnell. Nobody that I have seen has predicted that the Senate will go Democratic in November. Of course, it could theoretically happen, but I haven't seen any kind of predictions about that. So assuming the Senates have Republican control, Mitch McConnell's not going anywhere. And he says the trial on impeachment will occur before the first of the year. So, of course, if the Senate were to shift to Democratic control and Mitch McConnell were to try to jam in the impeachment trial before the January when people are sworn in, that would create a tremendous crisis, I believe, in this country. But hopefully we don't get to that. Hopefully we never get to that. In the meantime, the New York Post, disclosed a terrible situation right under our noses, right around Kennedy Airport and LaGuardia Airport. A woman is suing the Wyndham Hotels in a suit that is described as the first of its kind in New York because she is now in her 20s. She goes by the initials SJ. She says when she was only 10 years old, she was raped, tortured, and beaten regularly, sold for sex at two motels right around the airports, while the staff turned a blind eye to her obvious abuse. She is suing for $10 million. She claims she was sold for sex as often as 15 to 20 times a day at the Howard Johnson, operated in Jamaica, Queens, and the Econo Lodge in the Bronx, when she was between the ages of 10 and 13 years old. She said she had escaped from a foster home where she was sexually and physically abused. She met her trafficker. Her trafficker preyed on her, took advantage of her, took her virginity, and then said, if you want to make daddy happy, this is what you have to do. And so she was trafficked into this life. He was 25 years old at the time. She says the trafficker would put a paper bag over her head and take her to the Econo Lodge in Howard Johnson, where she'd spend days at a time being raped by clients nonstop. The trafficker paid for the rooms in cash, and when he didn't have money for rooms, he allowed hotel staff to rape her in lieu of payment. The suit states that there was even a bowl of free condoms displayed at the Econo Lodge's front desk the victims would use when they ran out. SJ claimed in the lawsuit there was constant and voluminous foot traffic in and out of the rooms. Numerous used condoms were left scattered across various surfaces at the end of each motel stay, which should have obviously alerted the staff that criminal activity was happening. And the suit states that both of the motels allowed the abuse to happen by failing to call law enforcement and ignoring the obvious warning signs, such as her clear physical abuse, her diminished personal hygiene, her lack of luggage, submissiveness, and inappropriate attire. You know what I have to say about this? I'm so happy somebody is being sued. That's what I have to say. You know, we, in society, we all have an obligation to see what's in front of us. And I don't believe in turning a blind eye. And I think it's nothing short of criminal to have this kind of activity go on underneath your nose to see a 10, 11, or 12-year-old come into a hotel room with a pimp and not call the police and not do anything about it. If these facts as alleged are true, there's an awful lot of blame to go around. An awful lot. These factories of prostitution of underage girls right underneath the noses of grown-ups who are taking the money or taking the sex or taking both. It's despicable behavior. It's unconscionable. It's so cruel. It's so cruel. So I'm happy that somebody is filing a lawsuit. Let's see what happens with it. Maybe it'll bring attention to the plight of other girls in other places. Because that's what we need to do. We need to stop this kind of cruelty and abuse. And we can't turn a blind eye to it when it's right in front of us. 203-333-9422. The Connecticut Mirror has a blockbuster report today about how Connecticut compares to other states in terms of investing in the census. For example, California is spending $187 million in 2020 compared to what it spent in 2010. It's a nine-fold increase over what they spent in 2010. New Jersey has committed $9.5 million, its first significant investment in the census. And New York City is spending a record $40 million. The state is adding another $20 million. Why? Why are they spending so much on the census? Because for the very, very, very first time, as we've talked about, as we've had guests on the show, they're going online. For the first time, the U.S. Census is going to ask the majority of Americans to answer the census online. And what does that do? It challenges people who don't really operate their lives online. Places where anywhere from 25% or more homes don't even have web access. Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, and Connecticut's smaller cities are dotted with neighborhoods and people like this. So what did we do in Connecticut to help our census get going? Zero. Zero. There are $0 being allocated in Connecticut toward the census. Zero. Massachusetts has appropriated $2.5 million. New York State, $60 million. New Jersey, $9.5 million. Connecticut, zero. Boston is even providing grants to nonprofits to help reach into hard-to-count communities. Even Rhode Island, at least they gave $500,000. So what does our Secretary of the State, Denise Merrill, have to say about this? She is the co-chair of the Connecticut Complete Count Committee, i.e. the Census Committee. She says the states have never had to put money in, to be honest. But this is the first year we're very worried because it's almost all online. Legislators earmarked no money for the census in the 2019 session. Zero. In Connecticut, the Complete Count campaign is overseen by our Lieutenant Governor, Susan Bisewitz. She says she hasn't given up on getting some money, but OPM, the Office of Policy and Management, they don't have any discretionary funds. Hard-to-count census tracts are defined as those where fewer than 74% of mailed surveys were completed. Of the 831 census tracts in Connecticut, 218 fell short of that number. Ouch. The three tracks with the lowest return rates are actually represented by our House Majority Leader, Matt Ritter of Hartford, Democrat of Hartford. 90% of the 563 households in a particular census tract in Hartford, which only has a 41% participation rate, were rentals. And 30% have no internet. And nearly half the residents have incomes below the poverty level. 27% of those are foreign-born. These are the hard-to-count tracts. Why does it matter? What are the stakes? How about $10.7 billion in federal aid? $10.7 billion. Census Bureau researchers estimated in 2017 that based on census data, the federal government handed out $675 billion nationwide. And that was in 2015. They include Medicaid, school lunch programs, Head Start, highway planning, Pell grants for college students, Section 8 housing vouchers, special ed grants, vocational rehabilitation grants. And we have allocated no money, as every state around us is seeing that this is going to be a problem. So what's going to happen is we're not going to be able to count all the people in Connecticut. And when we don't count them, we are not counted as a state in terms of our ratio of allocation of federal money because we have fewer people. Thank you, Connecticut Mirror, for doing such an in-depth investigative report today. $10.7 billion in federal aid at stake. You know, we're going to be speaking with Ned Lamont tomorrow, the governor, I think I'll ask him about this. Maybe he can find some money in the budget as a last-minute appropriation. People are very worried about this. It may be that the not-for-profits ante up. That's what they're doing in other states because they see that it equates to their bottom line. If they don't give, they're not going to get. They're not going to get the grants from the federal government that they need every single year to function if their people are not counted. And frankly, a lot of not-for-profits know how to count the people who typically don't answer the door. I'm Lisa Wexler. I want to thank you for joining us today. We're coming up on 12. We've got Paul Pacelli from 2 to 6 today. Very exciting. Connecticut Today. Clark Howard coming up next. And you can listen to the show or any portion you missed on SoundCloud, which will be up in probably about 20 minutes from now. Sans commercials. Thank you, Christian. Thank you, Ava, for help producing the show, for helping to produce the show today. And we'll be back tomorrow behind the mic with Scott Pelley and Governor Ned Lamont.